bit of a talk this evening in answer to Dimitri's question about God. It's interesting that Dimitri was very skeptical when I said that as Buddhists we didn't have an idea of God as such. And I think that this idea is so ingrained in people's perception of religion that it's very difficult for many people to conceive of or to imagine a genuine or profound spiritual path that simply bypasses the question of God. And one of the I guess aggravating things about Buddhism from a theistic point of view is the question is the big idea that if we look in the Buddhist texts and scriptures and so on, that they don't even bother to refute the existence of God very much. We find a few things here and there, but pretty much the Buddhist scriptures just simply ignore it for the most part. There's a few kind of satires, a few philosophical arguments here and there. But for the most part, Buddhism just goes along its way, and questions of God are simply not relevant, along with the other questions that most religions purport to give an answer to. Where does the world come from? In so doing, one of the assumptions that Buddhism brings to the table is a certain humility regarding the limits of our knowledge. And the question came up of the first and ultimate first beginning of the universe. The Buddha didn't say that the universe has a beginning or it doesn't have a beginning. He said it's unknowable. And then Sagokoi and so on. The point of things is unknowable. And so the truth claims that we usually find in theistic religions, of course, involve a rather kind of spectacular body of assumptions about what we can know. We can know the existence of the eternal heaven and hell. We can know the existence of a beneficent, perfect, omniscient, omnipotent creator of the universe. And we can know all kinds of things about what he thinks and what he wants. And certainly in popular theistic circles, you regularly find these kind of extraordinarily statements that people make seemingly very casually. Jesus wants us to, whatever, go to war with Iraq, or Jesus wants us to get rich, or whatever the latest thing is. And what God wants or what God doesn't want. And in some way it would seem to be very different from the Buddhist approach. In some ways obviously it is very different from the Buddhist approach. But perhaps there are certain similarities which underlie or which sort of qualify that difference. For example, I've noted before that the way in traditional Buddhism that we use the notion of karma is quite comparable, really, to how God or Allah is invoked in theistic religion. Whenever something happens that's inexplicable or disastrous or whatever, then if you're a Muslim, you say, Inshallah, the will of Allah, and that's it. You've explained it. It's a perfectly sufficient explanation. If you're a Christian, it's the will of God. If you're a Buddhist, you say, well, that's karma. And in each case, you've created a perfectly sufficient explanation, which from the point of view of the person making that explanation is self-evident. From a skeptical or secular point of view, looking at these kinds of claims, it's kind of remarkable how quick that we need to invoke these quite abstruse and unsure doctrines, bodies of ideology, in order to make sense of our reality. We don't say, oh, this was the will of God, or this was the will of Allah, or this was karma, out of an empirical investigation. We don't actually, first of all, inquire and find out whether God was in fact involved in that. We don't actually first look and see, well, was this a karmic thing? Did we find evidence for the involvement of karma in that particular thing? Someone gets sick, we say that's their karma, and we actually look and see, was there a karmic cause for that? So we don't do that. But we simply use the notion of karma like a kind of metaphysical bog. It's a metaphysical gap filler. We kind of stick it in all of those places where something seems to be a bit lacking. And it's useful or meaningful for us, not because there's any particular evidence for it in that particular case, but because it's congenial in the context of our larger ideas, beliefs, philosophies, ways of looking at the world. It's something which can be assimilated and which we can say, oh, this is, this can be fit within my worldview without too much challenge. I don't have to go on a metaphysical quest. I don't have to inquire deeply as to why these things are going. We can reassure ourselves, oh, this is karma. Why do babies who are born with HIV? Well, because they're karma. Why were so many people killed in the tsunami? Well, it's their karma. So we have these very kind of disturbing and uncomfortable realities which the world gives to us. And a very kind of handy and kind of universally useful tool that can make us feel comfortable around those things. And I think this aspect of these kinds of metaphysical ideal has goes a long way to explaining their tenacity in human culture. I remember reading the biography of Bishop Spong, and he talked about how kind of unsettling it was when he was at the seminary training to be a priest, and they taught him and the class were taught all about Bible studies and text-critical studies and seeing things in terms of their historical context and so on. And they learnt about how, you know, the story of the virgin birth was introduced into the biblical narratives at a certain time and a certain place from certain sources. And they learnt about all of these kinds of things. And they developed a culture where they would engage with the text, question it and seek for meaning with it that way. And then when they left the college, it seemed to Bishop Spong that all of the priests would then go off into their parishes and do their work, and then just start preaching the same old platitudes that have been heard a million times before. And then the virgin birth comes in and all of these kinds of things. And it seems like in some way it's too hard to really take these truths seriously. Most people aren't willing or don't have enough interest or investment or really to work in to make sense of it. And so we tend to coast along, to drift back to a kind of lowest common denominator. Similar thing happens in Buddhism, say, with the notion of karma that I've been talking about. So this kind of way of looking at karma obviously has nothing to do with what the Buddha talked about when he met with karma. He was precisely refuting and reforming those kinds of ideas and notions of karma when he claimed that karma was intention, precisely not your fate or your destiny, precisely your choice, which is karma. It's a very revolutionary doctrine. It's your choice which is karma. But that is a very hard teaching. That's something which we really struggle to be able to accept. That's something which so much of thought processes are concerned to hide from us, to argue away, to explain away. When we meditate, when we look into our mind, we start to recognize the patterns that thought moves in. And how many times do we recognize those kinds of blaming thoughts, for example? So-and-so was wrong, so-and-so did this. And all of that blaming is all externalizing. It's all a denial of our radical responsibility for our own existence and our own situation. And so these explaining narratives that we go on in our mind are a symptom of our lack of acceptance. It's interesting, if we look at those kinds of thought processes, and one way of analyzing it is simply in terms of what pronouns that we're using. This is actually a useful trick to use in your meditation when you find that you're overtaken with thoughts and you can't shake them off. What pronoun are you using? Because you remember that whatever thoughts you're doing, whatever conversation you're having, only you are there. All those other people in your thoughts are not, they don't actually live in your brain. They're not there with you in the putti in the middle of the night. So those thoughts you have about other people, they belong to you. So if those thoughts are put into, they're all parts of your mind. So if you put the thoughts in terms of a third person narrative, he, she, it, then how many people are involved in that? Someone's talking. Presumably you're imagining that someone's listening, I don't know who's listening, and then the person who's being spoken about actually isn't present in your imagination, they're somewhere else. So this is the sign of a mind which has fragmented to the degree that it's these aspects of oneself that one's actually in dialogue with are conceived as being other. It's quite separate. You're in another room and having a conversation about somebody who's not there. So if you think about all of those people, the person who's the one who's speaking, the one who's being spoken to, and the one who's being spoken about, they're all just aspects of your own mind. And if the one who's spoken about is in the third person, that means they're not even in the room. That's how dissociated that thought pattern is. Think about how it feels if you're there and if two people are talking about you in the third person. Yeah? Oh, she'll do this, or she's like that, or she's no good at this, or something like that. Then, and you're there listening to it, and you go, excuse me, hello, I'm here, she's here, or he's here. And it's you feel very, very alienated and isolated by that. You feel very cut off. You feel quite insulted that they can't bring themselves to talk to you. So that's the situation if we're doing a third person narrative in our mind. If it's a second person narrative, then it's a little bit better. We're actually facing somebody face to face. So we've still got a split in our mind. Part of it is the speaker is what we identify as us, and then another part of our mind we associate with some other person, but at least we can talk to them so that there's a communication happening. So that's a much better state of affairs. And best of all, of course, is one when the dialogue is first person. And so it's the I speaking for itself. But of course, once the I realizes that it's just speaking and it's really integrated, and it realizes that there's no one around to listen, then it'll probably feel a bit embarrassed and shut up, which is also very good for meditation. So that's a good little analytical structure to use to help kind of bring bring the thought, rein the thoughts in and bring them home. If you find yourself going on with those kinds of third person narratives, try bringing it to a second person narrative. Yeah? Instead of blaming he, she, it, criticizing them or talking about them, then invite them into the room and talk to them. And then you can talk from that point of view, just the first person narrative to finish. And then the mind will quieten down. So to come back to that theme of karma and meaning, I think that there's this idea or this sense of fear which underlies a lot of these things. A sense of, like you were sort of, well, since we're in a cave here, I guess we think of cavemen. Not that I, certainly don't want to think of cavemen in any sense of derogatory sense. Cavemen are good. And I don't want anyone to be insulted by my use of the term cavemen. I just think people are in caves. And night comes and you've got a little bit of a fire going and outside is just the dark. There's things moving in the dark. What are they? Blue mammoths, saber-toothed tigers, or just a primordial wombat. Could be anything. And so you have like this kind of tiny circle of light which is shed by your fire. And outside that, everything is unknown and potentially quite dangerous. And so I think we use these ideas, whether God or karma or something like that, to name those things that live in the darkness. Those, that sound, what's that? Oh, well, that's just God moving in the dark. When we name those things and when we name them, we feel a sense of control over them. Naming has been shown in psychological studies that if we can name something, we feel more comfortable with it. We kind of got it under control. We've got a word for it. So it seems to me that the world is a very big and very scary place. The light of our mind, of our consciousness, sheds only just a little bit around us. Nothing more than that. And we spend our lives looking in that little bit of sunlight that we can actually see. I remember Princess Prabhavati or Bhadra Kapilani, who were supposed to be so beautiful that they shed golden light for a couple of meters around them in all directions, even in the midst of the night. And that, in a sense, that's what we're actually like. That's what our consciousness is like. We're there, we see that light because we're there in the middle of it. But somehow we know that the darkness is outside. Somehow we know that. We're faced with this uncertainty, the uncertainty of the future, the uncertainty of the past, the uncertainty of the other, the uncertainty of change. And our belief systems, our spiritual and religious systems, reassure us, they give us confidence that darkness has some sense to it. So we have a general understanding and a general sense of meaning. And so this is why when the ridiculous happens, if the specific things happen, then we so readily fall back on these explanations. Oh, this was God, or this was Allah, this was karma, or whatever. What we're really saying is that this is not really the unknown. This is not really so terrifying. And of course the reality is that we're completely wrong. The reality is that it is actually unknown. The reality is that life is in fact terrifyingly uncertain, and that no amount of sticking labels like it's the will of God or it was their karma is going to help, apart from just giving us that sense of comfort. It doesn't solve the problem. Little babies still die of AIDS. Girls get taken at 12 years of age and put into brothel. Innocent people get bombed. People have heart attacks when they're young for no good reason. All of these things happen. They're happening every day. And they happen to us. They don't just happen out there. We also are very, just as much subject to that uncertainty, to the sickness, to the death, to the danger, as anyone else is. And if you get sick and then somebody says to you, oh, well, that must have been your karma, is that any use to you at all? Is that any better than saying, here, have a lolly? And take your mind off it and make you feel a bit better about it. Is it really any more use to you than that? So this is, I think, what Jung was talking about when he said that the purpose of religion was to protect the religious devotee from the divine. The purpose of a religion is not to lead you to an experience of the truth. It's to hide you from. It's to shelter you from. You know, in the old days, in the time of the Rig Veda, the ancient Brahmins used to worship the gods of the sky, the Marutas or Jyals, who was called Zeus, of course, in Greece. And these gods of the sky were gods of the thunder and the thunderbolt, the lightning. And they would take their worship out in the middle of nature and set up a temporary shrine there on the ground, on the earth, with the elements, the fire, the water, with the sky above them. And in the stars and in the lightning and in the rain and in the wind, that would be their worship. And later on, we got more comfortable. We built temples. We built houses for God. But those houses for God are not really houses for God. They're prisons for God. A church or a temple or a mosque or a synagogue, these are all prisons for God. They're places where we can conceal and contain the truth. Put four walls around it, restrict it, and hold it. And with our dogmas and our doctrines and our rituals and our traditions and all of the elaborate paraphernalia that religions evolve over the millennia, we believe that we've captured God or the divine or the truth or whatever you want to call it. And in fact, all that we've done is to chain it up. And so if we want, that chaining is not necessarily a bad thing. God, we read about God in the Old Testament, read about God in any of the old mythologies. God is violent, unpredictable. He's wild. He's just watch out. And so is she. When it's a she as well, she's no better. So she needs taming and caging, no doubt about that. I wouldn't let Kali out loose on the population. It would be an act of hideous irresponsibility. No, we have to get her and tie her up and put her in a cage. We'll just bring her out occasionally on ceremonies, and everyone can, we can kill a few thousand cows and oxen and so on, keep Kali happy, and then please put her back in the cage. And Jehovah, he's much more civilized now. Now that he's in the cage, yeah, he's got this nice church around him and so on, and he doesn't go around smite, well, there's still this bit of smiting done in his name, but there's, we don't find the same kind of Sodom and Gomorrah and the pillars of chalk and all of these kinds of things and the plagues of Egypt and all of those kinds of things. He's been civilized. He's been tamed. Which is an entirely good thing. And, you know, much better off having God's representative being a vicar who you can have a nice cup of tea and scones with on the back lawn is a much more amenable form of spirituality than the blood-smeared patriarchs of the Old Testament. Falling down their belligerent god of war and thunder. So we shouldn't think that this taming of God in general or in a social sense is necessarily a bad thing. But it's different. It's different for those who really want to meet the real thing. You're not going to do that by having tea with the vicar on the back lawn. You're not going to see the awe-inspiring truth that the Buddha saw by participating in an offering ritual in a Buddhist temple. If you want to actually go there, then you need to do something quite different. You need to be prepared to face the uncertainty of things. You need to be uncowed and unafraid. You need to be able to go out there in the dark, to listen to what the wind is saying, to feel what the earth feels like, to see the space that recedes between the stars. It's outside of the forms of the religion that the real religious and spiritual insight will happen, not inside them. And this is why in this monastery and in the forest monasteries that I love to live in, we have only a minimal amount of ritual and ceremony and so on. People say, oh well, I feel better with more support if we had this or we had that. That's exactly the point. You shouldn't have support. You need to go and sit in your kuti and think, well, here I have this afternoon and this evening. There's nothing. Those supports are not there. And see, that's when you start to understand the nature of time. That's when you start to experience the unfolding of time, when that's all there is. And time is another thing which we've tamed. We've measured it and divided it. We've made calendars. We've made days for this and days for that and weeks and months and seconds, and we divide it. We tame time. We think we know it. See, time is just this huge mystery. We don't know anything about it. So what we tend to do when we enter our spiritual practice is that we have let go of, well, we've seen through and we're trying to move beyond those kind of meaning-giving structures which were useful for us So, for example, that might be our career or our family or our studies or something like that. So kind of to tell you the ordinary stuff of life, which most people find gives them enough satisfaction. When it comes to monastic life, we want something more or something else. There's something that's giving us different kinds of answers and perhaps more profound kinds of answers. And so we move into a place of uncertainty. There's a breaking down of the structures and the forms that we're used to. And this creates a sense of anxiety in us. We want to know, we want to answer, well, what is this, what is that? How do we behave? What do we do here? What do we do there? And of course what happens then is that we start to construct a whole new set of attachments that replace the old one. And this is a gradual process. And it's interesting, you can see this in the career of monks, and I haven't seen known enough nuns over a long period of time to be able to comment, but although probably a similar mechanism happens. But certainly with the monks, what you tend to see is that when the new monks come along, that they are very idealistic, and that they there's a kind of a great sense of openness and sort of a close engagement with the actual spiritual aspects of the religious path which they've chosen. Now, in a sense, that is a substitute device, an avoidance device, because they're still so close to the world and so close to the worldly way of doing things that there needs to be very often a strong deprecation of the worldly things, and together with a strong attachment to the spiritual things. And so, you know, often you find people get very kind of a bit of fanatical or obsessive about Vinaya. Vinaya has to be like this or like that, and these people are wrong because they're doing it that way or so on. Or else it'll be kind of have a dogmatic thing that there's a right way and a wrong way, and this is what the suttas say, so this must be right, and this is what other monks said, so this must be right, and so on. They have these kinds of tendencies which you often find in young monks, which I interpret as being this kind of need to reinstitute new structures as the old structures have fallen away as time goes on. Hopefully as grow in maturity and confidence, then there becomes less need to be insistent on these things, and more openness and more flexibility. But what there also happens at that then, as monks get more senior, is that their concerns tend to revert back to the institution. And there's this kind of old joke about that if you listen to what young monks talk about, they're always talking about food. If you listen to what middle monks are talking about, they're always talking about tudong. And if you listen to the senior monks, they're always talking about building projects. And they're disturbing, depressingly accurate. And so with age, and partly it's an age thing, and partly, you know, because you're in a position of responsibility or whatever, then there comes to be this sort of more emphasis on the institutional aspect of religion, build the buildings and all that kind of stuff. And I think what we've seen with the recent controversy in Bhikkhunis and so on is that for the monks, as they get more senior, these institutional aspects actually become almost completely overshadow that earlier idealism. And many people have expressed surprise that so many monks who are so senior can be so attached to the institutions and the forms of Buddhism. And to me, that's not at all surprising. That's what I've seen in my whole life since I've been a monk, is that it's the senior ones who are more, get more and more attached to the forms of things and to the traditions and all of these kinds of things. Which I think is rather a shame. Obviously it's not true for everyone, it's just a generalization. But I think there's something for us to contemplate there. If we're aware of that, aware of those tendencies, then we can manage it better. It's not to say that, that it's wrong, it's just to say that it's a process in development that can be either healthy or unhealthy. So if we become, if we get too concerned with the notion of Buddhism, then we lose that ability to really confront that scary abyss. We lose the freshness and the spontaneity that comes from doing something that's truly new. Now, our lives as monastics, and there are certain things that we do. We do bad things, and we do chores and so on. And we do work and service for the Buddhist community. We engage with helping people to get their visas and to spread Buddhist education and publications and things like that. So there's a certain degree of our practice which needs to be involved with those things, and that's healthy, but they also need to be left behind, and we need to know what that's like when none of those things are there. What's that really like? What's that really like when you go into the bush and don't even meditate? You find this kind of almost compulsion of the mind to start making sense of things. It'll either drift off and start thinking about things, or it'll start some kind of meaning generating process. This is what the mind is, to a large extent, an organ for generating meaning, for making sense out of things. So when we cut through that, and we cut through the thought which is always interpreting present experience based on what's happened to us in the past, and we just know, then that's a very kind of naked experience. That's very challenging. Comes times when, like, the veil will drop, and mind will see, and it'll recoil in horror. Maybe you'll scream. Maybe you'll feel sick. Maybe there'll be a convulsion through your whole body. And you can, when you see the terrifying darkness that is the ignorance of our own mind, this is something that's very, very deeply alien. This is what avijja is. It's something which is so familiar. We live with it every day. And yet our masking, our denial, our avoidance is so sophisticated and so pervasive that when we see this thing, it's just unbelievable. It's just beyond comprehension that our mind can actually be operating, that our lives can go on, that we can eat Weet-Bix in the morning with a mind that is still full of such darkness and such ignorance. And when we have the courage to face it, I think, this is, if we look at our behaviours in the forest monastery, we can see that a lot of our behaviours are avoidance behaviours, of trying to getting involved in things, getting involved in conversations, getting involved in projects, getting involved in chocolate stupor making. And why are we doing that? What are we doing? Avoiding looking at this out of darkness. We're really not sure what we're going to see. We're really a bit nervous about that. And of course the good news is that as we've been told by countless fairy tales, that when the princess kisses the frog, it turns into a handsome prince. When you can finally embrace the beast, it turns into something very beautiful. And that's the miracle of transformation, the miracle of wisdom. When we can steel ourselves to actually know ignorance and know unknowing, then that becomes the known. It becomes what is familiar. It becomes normal. And so then we genuinely lose our fear. And this is not the, we're not sort of losing our fear because of the kinds of mechanisms I was talking about earlier in the talk. Of, you know, we haven't explained it away. We haven't just given it a name or a label and then sort of wrapped it up and made it a bit comfortable for us. But we genuinely don't have any fear. With all of those kind of excuses and labels and ideas, there's always the fear is always underlying them. They're just a palliative. But when we can really stride out into the darkness and really encounter it, then it just doesn't have any terror for us at all. And then we start to know what the mind is like, but has no fear. What's the mind like when it has no doubt? What is the mind like when it has no delusion? And then the clarity of the mind, the light of the mind, the wisdom of the mind, start to shine forth. Not just in narrow and particular senses, not just being wisdom or understanding about this thing or that thing, but in terms of a life. That will embrace and radiate on everything. From the good and the bad. From the ugly and the beautiful. This is my little talk for you this evening. And I offer this to you for your reflection. And I can invite if there's any comments or questions.
What do you think about the tension exists between the image of Buddhism and the religion of, you know, guys and girls, which is comforting and warm.
Yeah, well, I think that's one good thing about Buddhism, more than other religions, that you know, we still do have that kind of those kinds of really serious and kind of quite edgy practices that still. Actually, very common in meditation, even you know, standard Goenka retreats and so on. Very difficult and tough practices. There's nothing comparable in other religions as well. Right? So, I think there is an understanding. I think most people have an understanding that serious practice actually takes a lot of energy and a lot of endurance.
What about in a lot of not in other Buddhist literature, they talk about, you know, Buddha nature as an equivalent to the concept of God. When did that happen? Does it seem to be part of Theravada thinking?
No. But that idea, the Buddha nature idea as such, originated in the what they call the Yogacara school of Buddhism, and probably from around 400 AD started to be articulated fairly explicitly. maybe implicit beforehand in certain ideas and so on, but more explicitly there. The meaning of it, of course, shifts and changes across the different writers and texts and so on. But the Pali word, or the Sanskrit word that they use for it, is Tathagata Garbha, which literally means the embryo of the Buddha. It's the literal meaning of it. And so the original idea was very simply that everyone has the potential for awakening within themselves. So in that sense, obviously, it's quite common among all the Buddhist traditions. So that's the kind of the simple common sense way, but of course it came to have philosophical implications which were taken quite a long way beyond that. The idea of calling it Buddha nature actually is an English translation stemming from the Chinese renderings of the term. But there's no actual Indic equivalent of the word Buddha nature. But I think, and I think that it's often understood, and I think probably quite rightly, that in some ways the development of those kinds of ideas was influenced by, or perhaps an attempt to accommodate the non-dualist tendencies in Hinduism that were emerging around that time. So, you know, in that sense, yes, it is sort of trying to make, in a sense, it's making the world more reassuring, you know, rather than the emphasis on dukkha, anicca dukkha anatta, things impermanent and so on. And you find in some of the texts of that class and that period, so a bit later, maybe you say 500 or 600 AD, you find texts that will actually sort of, all dhammas are permanent, stable, enduring, endowed with selfhood, they remain fixed for all eternity, and all these kinds of things. So pretty kind of explicit counter narrative going on there.
And then the other day, I think someone had been in the book that may the Buddha be with you all.
Mm-hmm.
So where does this kind of idea come from, that the Lord Buddha?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of... Oh, look, no, I mean, that kind of general way of thinking, that's pretty common in popular Buddhism around the place. I mean, it's one of these things, it's people's, most of the time, is that our views on things aren't really examined. So we're quite capable, on the one hand, of saying, may the Lord Buddha watch over you. And on the other hand, if you ask that person, you know, explicitly, you know, do you really believe that there's a living Buddha who's watching over people? And they probably say, well, no. But, you know, from a more developed Mahayana perspective, they do develop that in a more philosophically consistent manner, and so they sort of say that there are countless Buddhas in the past, future, and also in the present in different world systems. So even though we don't have our Buddha, but in other solar systems, other galaxies, there's plenty of Buddhas, and all of those Buddhas, countless millions of Buddhas in the past and the future and the present, all of them are omniscient, in a literal sense of omniscient. So they're always constantly aware of everything, everywhere, all the time, past, present and future. Right. But that means that they're aware of you and that they're watching you right here, right now, and that there's billions of Buddhas all through the cosmos in the past, present and future for eons, all of them thinking about you with love and compassion and wanting you to be happy right now. So it's not, doesn't leave you a lot of places to hide. I think you when you're in the toilet or something like that as well. But it's a very beautiful idea. You know, it's a very friendly universe if you think about the universe.
Yeah.
Isn't the will of God or inshallah or something confused in the same way?
No, because if God will do that to you rather than you deserve it because you've done something bad in response and then you're being retributed for something like that, like very different because God can be very mystical sometimes. Yeah, it's not like putting the fault on you, but rather than, you know, somebody being on that.
Yeah, well, potentially, it would be possible to understand that practically speaking, I think that most people, you know, if something bad happened and then they said, you know, I mean, if your daughter got, you know, was like 2 years old and then she got, you know, terminally ill and you went to the priest for consolation and he said, well, it's God's will, I think most people would feel pretty guilty about it. Think, what have I done wrong? Why?
Yeah, but that's more their like their guilty. So guilty and asked to feel guilty about anything, whether it's
or not. No, I don't think so. I think that's just created by the construct. It's because God is good and God is the big daddy in the sky and so on, and he's punishing me. That's why you feel guilty.
I don't know if it's punishing you, it's punishing the person who's dead.
Whatever. Yeah, sure. Sure, I mean, that's what I was saying, that there is that aspect of comfort, and I don't want to downplay that on a social level. But the point I was trying to make was that's got nothing to do with God as such. It's got nothing to do with the karma as such. It's a concept which would make sense within our particular belief framework, which gives us that sense of comfort or relief or meaning or something like that. And so that's all we can expect from it, which may be quite a lot, you know. I mean, maybe that's all that most people want. It seems to be that's all that most people want, isn't it? Okay. And now you don't want to really discover God and really understand what God is, but you just want to have a bit of, you know, that makes me feel nice about it.
I saw it in Thomas, you know, actually seeing him recently. He was asked to a very raucous party and he said, oh, no, I don't think I want to go there, I'm just going to get drunk and have sex and I'm not interested in doing this. And I said, good. He said, but can you ring him up and say that you're not letting me go? And I'm like, sure, I can make it better. He said, because, you know, I can't tell him that I just don't want to go. But if I say that, you know, you won't let me, then that is yeah. So, do that. comfort of your body.
Exactly, yeah. You externalize. This is in the Sutta report about karma being choice, actually. So the point of the teaching of karma is to make us reflect that actually we're responsible for our choices. That actually that's used in popular Buddhist culture to make exactly the opposite. Is that it's bad and there's nothing we can do about it. And so in a sense you've externalized the responsibility.
I guess that can give the impression that the best way to practice is to be alone in the wilderness. But is there a sense that you can develop a nakedness in your wilderness?
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Yeah, I mean, being psychically naked is much more threatening than being physically naked. Yeah. So if you think about how threatening that would be to actually walk naked into a shopping centre, okay, and how that's going to, being actually psychically naked with someone is much more difficult. I mean, you can think of that that's literally true, and it is exactly like that thing of Thomas's party. Very easy for people to get together and have casual sex, be completely physically naked and intimate with each other, but how much is it harder for them to actually be emotionally intimate? You know? And emotionally honest and vulnerable. Much more. It's much rarer to find.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be that that's the space for listening.
I heard a great quote the other day from Mother Teresa. Somebody asked, "What do you do when you pray?" And she says, "Oh, I just listen." And then they said, "Well, what does God do? Does he talk to you?" She said, No, he just listens as well.
So, in if you set out to expose your consciousness, then I've witnessed various problems with that.
Definitely.
Is that you can go completely bonkers and not function at all in society or in the world generally.
Yeah.
So the structures and rituals and institutions all particularly make sense.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the say, for example, that's part of the structure of the hero's journey. You know, you go out into the wilderness, you know, lose everything, and all the structures break down. But then it depends on the scale or the degree of the hero is, do they just remain there or are they able to actually return and reintegrate? So a truly successful hero is able to reintegrate that.
So you don't just eat cactus and wander around and visit.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, and in the Buddha's case, that was, you know, setting up the Sangha and so on, and that's the difference, say, between the Buddha and, say, Pacheka Buddha. So the Pacheka Buddhas would go out and get enlightened, and then they just live by themselves in caves, and they might do a bit of teaching here and there, but they don't set up a Sangha or anything formal or organized. And so the Buddha sort of set up those structures. Became much more integrated in the social fabric. And that's, of course, then that's a whole nother set of tests and challenges, you know, and the whole, you can look at, you know, the whole of the Buddha's life, he was overcoming the challenges that brought about, you know. What do you do then when there's the jealousy that comes in, the competition? What do you do when people start joining that social structure who are very unenlightened and very bad in their behavior? And so that was what the Buddha spent 45 years doing. I mean, if you look at it in perspective, it was 6 years practicing in the wilderness. And then 45 years trying to get the Sangha to display the behavior done. Okay, so this is the finished my manuscript.
Thank you.